dude. You gotta work at it. And
yeah, they say it's like the guitar is like the probably the easiest instrument to learn how to play, but the most mm-hmm. difficult to master, because it's not like a keyboard where like everything's linear, right? Because you've got that linearness of the neck, and then everything also going, you know,
yeah,
horizontally as well.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, yeah, exactly. The neck cuts off at some point, and it's not, it's not linear, like you said,
yeah.
like a keyboard.
Yeah.
But I love it. It gets you through hard time, like a rough day picking up a guitar.
Yeah.
But,
puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
I find.
So you're in high school at this moment. Yep. Playing in
the Joe Garage. Smith Band.
The Joe Smith Band. That's such a great name. Should have kept the it. Joe Smith
I,
Band.
I still laugh about it after all these years. Yeah, it was John Burdick, the other guitar player, who actually thought of it, and he was just a really funny guy, good guy. But yeah, it was always a kind of a goof.
Yeah.
But yep. Yeah. So.
So what happened? So what's next? You go. So you went to Berkeley.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Like, you hear people, like, I've watched videos from people who went there. You hear about John Mayer talking about it.
Yeah.
There's that guy, Tomo, his professor there.
Well, when I went there, I mean, first of all, it was like super intimidating, right? Because you know, you think you're good playing in your little high school band, but you get there with like all these other kids from all over the country, all over the world, actually. And you just, you know, you're just so insignificant, man. And there's just like rows and rows of like practice rooms, and you're just walking down to get an empty practice room. And there's all these different musicians at all different levels, right? Some who were incredible, some were, you know, learning like I was. So there's that. But it was a lot different back then, too, compared to what it is today. It was a lot smaller school. And today it's just, I think they ended up buying like New England Conservatory, Boston Conservatory. So it's just this behemoth now. And it's a lot harder to get into now. It's way more competitive than when I went there. But to, you know, to answer your question, it was a really great experience. I mean, you're surrounded by music 24/7, but also at the same time, I kind of felt like, you know, I got kind of like sick of it, like that, just that it was just like music. It was like music overload almost, because I, you know, wanted like other things in my life instead of just, you know, getting up, studying, going to rehearsal room, because it's not like regular college, right? It's kind of like the artistic equivalent of going to like a Division I college for sports, because you're constantly training with your team. You're working out to be, you know, develop the muscles you need to be able to perform better and so forth, all while doing your academic work. And the same thing with a music school, you know, you're doing your academic work. And then you've got your instrument, and you practice that every day. But
you feel it took like it. So it took a little bit of the. You feel it took a little bit of the fun or the like beauty out of it a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, in
you.
Some ways. Yeah, definitely in some ways. And then after, you know, basically about 3 years of studying music, and then I just. It wasn't what I wanted to continue doing anymore. So then a buddy of mine went out and we started a band. And then I just started playing in bands in Boston from there. And so, that's what I really discovered that I like to do is, you know, work within the context of a band, you know, creating songs, because I didn't really know how to do it myself. I mean, I would write out like, you know, chords and melodies and things like that, but I didn't sing, and you know, I didn't really know like how to develop drum parts, and also we didn't really have like the tools to do that, right? Like, okay, I could sit down and work at it.
So what time period is this?
Eighties.
Eighties.
Yeah. Yeah, in the 80s. So you know, within the context of a band, you had bass, keys, drums, guitars, vocals. So then we were able to work out, you know, somebody would bring in like the sketches of a song. So it'd be like, you know, chord changes for the verse, chord changes for the chorus, melody and so forth, and some basic arrangement. And then we kind of like hash it out together and develop like the different parts together and stuff. And that was really cool.
So what area are you playing live?
That was in Boston. Okay. Yeah. And so that was a really, you know, it was a great time. It was just a lot of fun doing that and learning. And, you know, we used to rehearse a lot. We probably, you know, we all had day jobs.
And you're playing originals?
Like, originals? Yeah, all originals. Awesome. Yeah, that's the only, I've never played in a cover band except for in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, so never interested me, right? Like, I didn't want to play in a wedding band. Didn't want to, like, not knocking anybody who does that. But it just wasn't something that I was interested in.
So just really, I've always been interested in this. Like, so going into Berklee,
yeah.
Where is your like overall musical knowledge when it comes to
like when I started there?
Like theory, yeah, like before then.
Okay, so that's so before I went there, the guy I was taking lessons from in high school, Steve Raleigh, was teaching me theory, you know, behind like chord formulation, like how to, you know, formulate a chord, how to build a chord, you know, what the different chord extensions are, what they mean, you know, major scales, minor scales, the modes and things like that. So going into Berklee, I had a pretty good foundation, and then it just, you know, evolved from there. But, you know, that's really it.
Yeah.
And then you can take that to, you know, like different levels, like arranging for strings, arranging for horns. And we would do that, right? We'd have these big sheets of paper. We'd have to write out like horn charts, you know.
For, so
like,
you would have to write for other instruments
to
prove.
And then and which was cool because you could then go and get those charts played, right? So, and we would do that because there's just so many musicians there. So you go to an ensemble and you'd give them the charts and,
did people like join bands together? Like,
oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
That's pretty cool.
You had to do recitals and, you know, things like that. So it was good. I mean, it was a great experience and I learned a ton of stuff. But it just, for me personally, it got to be like almost like musical overload.
Yeah.
And what was weird too is like, you know, we would go and play in, there's a bunch of guys that I hooked up with from California that we would just go and we would, you know, just reserve like a rehearsal room. And these were horn players and a bass player and trying to think, drummer, obviously. And we had some keyboards too. So there was a book called The Real Book, which is basically just a book of jazz standards. And that everybody, that's like the Bible at Berklee. At least it was at that time. I'm not sure how it is now. And everybody had that book and we would just go down and play jazz standards. So we'd just, you know, be reading from, you know, from the book, the chord changes
and
the melodies.
Like layman's terms, like why was that the go-to
book?
Why was
that the Bible?
Yeah.
Well, Berklee at that time was just a jazz school. That was it.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. There was really no, it was like, you're going to go and you're going to learn jazz. And now it's, you know, they have like everything there. They have like songwriting classes and, you know, rock and all kinds of stuff. But it definitely was not that back at the time. And so this book, which is basically, it was like a pirated book, right? So like there was just like some dude literally on the street selling these books for $50, right? But it was required of everybody. It was just kind of bizarre, right?
Yeah.
Like the number one required book at Berklee at that time was some pirated book of jazz standards. And the book, you know, the book's like this thick. So I've got one. It's in the closet over there.
Crazy.
I'll show it to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you can just see it's all like Xerox copies of, you know, this all these different works that nobody's getting paid their royalties on.
So it's like a compilation of like
All jazz standards, yeah, okay. Like all classic, you know, bebop.
But it was written by a bunch of different people.
Different composers, yeah. Okay. Yeah, all, yeah, just, yeah, I'll show it to you so you have a better idea of what I'm talking about. But anyway, so, yeah, that's kind of what it was like. And, but at least for me, I just got so, like, for me, when I started getting into a buddy of mine who went there with me, Tom, turned me on to like a lot of the new wave and punk stuff. So we'd be listening to like the Buzzcocks. We'd be listening to, you know, the Pretenders, like the first album, bands like XTC. Mm. Trying to think of some other ones. And we'd listen to some Bowie, you know, so that to me was like really liberating. You know, because I wasn't learning like, you know, jazz 2-5-1 progressions and, you know.
Sure. Yeah. And you're playing that. So you're playing that type of music live, originals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's like the name of the
techno
band?
Oh, the band? Well, the first one I was in, we called it Man Ray.
Man Ray.
So
I like that.
Named after the artist. And then the second one was Q. And then I played with this Brazilian singer, Jules Seabra, for a little while too. And then basically, and then it just was kind of like the end of like the band period for me.
So that culminates like late 80s or?
Yeah, like early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like early 90s. And then it was just, you know, doing stuff. Just myself and writing. And
so do you have like a job on the side while you're doing this, or are you making money?
Absolutely. Yeah. Unless, you know, unless you got like a record deal or you could put something together where you wanted to go on tour, you know, you were definitely working day jobs for sure. So it was, you know, it was a lot of work, but it was really great. It was a great experience. Definitely. Those were like formative years.
Yeah.
Learned a lot, you know, met some great, great people, really talented musicians. So, yeah. But, you know, I'm still working a day job.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I'm same here. Yeah. So when do you get into like production and all that? Like early, like while you're at Berkeley?
That was the 80s. You know, we started, all of us in the band together really worked at that. We bought like one of the first Mac computers that we would use to like sequence our keyboards. And then so we would hook it up to a 4-track. We had like a mixing board and then a little 4-track that came off of that and like a reverb, like a rack reverb. And that was the setup that we would record every rehearsal, like every single rehearsal. And our rehearsals were, you know, they were probably at least 3 hours every, you know, 4 nights a week.
Wow.
So there's a lot of tapes floating around there somewhere. Yeah. So
do you have any of them or?
I don't. Some of the guys in the band do, but it's kind of hard because a lot of the, you know, they're old. Right. So the tape, like the iron oxide particles are like, you know, coming off. So I know that they're trying to digitize a lot of the stuff. Yeah. But I don't know. I look at it like this. Like to me, it's like that period of time like happened and, you know, I'm not nostalgic for it. Let's put it
really?
That way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to, you know, just to keep moving forward, listening to new music. And I don't want to ever be. You know, it's funny. I don't want to ever be like stuck in a rut where like, you know, like the only band I'm listening to is like this, the same shit I listened to in high school. Right.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the guitar teachers that I had, a guy by the name of John Paiva, who was actually a studio guy. And at the time I was taking lessons from him, he had just finished playing with, like the new version of the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli and those guys. I don't know if you know.
I know.
So he was on tour with them. And,
that's awesome.
You know, and so he was out in LA recording with them and so forth. And one of the things he said to me was like his biggest fear was kind of not being like current on like what music is relevant, right?
Yeah.
And or like just not being aware of it. And I totally relate to that. And it's not a fear for me because I feel like I'm dialed in. I know what I like musically, right? Yeah. I like to keep like exploring and learning new things.
That's good. Yeah, I sometimes fall on the other end of that where I listen to the same bands for a few months. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's
but you're not
stuff
like going
up.
Back and like limiting your like listening experience.
I don't intentionally limit anything. Yeah. I'll just be like,
well, you have like a genre that you prefer, or
I don't even believe I'm super like liberal with the thoughts about genre and stuff. Like I don't like if I'm writing a song like you know, I'm not really thinking about like genre and stuff, and like even listening to it, like my favorite all time band is Guns N' Roses, right?
Right.
And their first album, which is like universally known as their best album,
sure,
is completely different from their next best album, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, which are like piano songs, and stuff like that. So, I don't have a specific genre really, but I do find myself listening to a lot of 70s, a lot of 90s stuff.
Yeah.
But I like new stuff too. Like, do you know Polyphia?
Have
you
No.
Ever? Oh, you got to check out them. He's doing weird stuff with the guitar. It's like, it's a little bit of like, you know, musicianship.
Actually,
flexing.
I think Chris Nunez turned me on to him.
It's like EDM guitar.
Yes. I did hear. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. I like it, but it's not necessary. Like, I love it, respect it, but it's, you know, if his song comes on in my shuffle, I might listen to it, but I'm not going out to like seek it out. So I do find myself listening to a lot of older stuff. It's good that you are like, you know, we're kind of the opposite of that.
I like listening to all of it, but what I find myself doing is like I walk for like an hour every morning. And so usually on my walk, I'll just say, hey Siri, you know, play some music. And, you know, I might pull up something that I've heard before. There's like, and then I'll just have her do it again.
Yeah.
And then I'll just get some random stuff. And then the algorithm will just go on from there. So that's how I kind of listen to get turned on to a lot of new stuff, and then I'll just add it to my library, and then it just kind of it builds and expands, you know, from there.
Yeah, that's kind of you shuffle like just, and the algorithm kind of knows what you like.
Yeah,
so it'll
feeds you more of what you're into.
But you like kind of everything. Like
I do.
I'm kind of like that too. Like I love like I was listening to New Edition earlier. Like I listened to literally whatever.
I mean, I don't like, you know, why would you want to like pigeonhole yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I just think it's so dumb.
Well, there's beauty even in like a lot of the most simple pop songs. It's like,
absolutely.
There's a reason, there's a science to it. And, you know, they're doing crazy stuff with production and stuff. So,
yeah.
There's good types of music in all genres.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
But, okay, so currently you've put together Home Studio Craft, which is like the all-in-one course. And so just talk about like putting that together and stuff and the why behind that.
Yeah. So Home Studio Craft, I mean, essentially it was, so I'm still looking to try to, you know, make a living off of music, right? But something that I can, you know, kind of like that give and take that I can, you know, if somebody comes to me, I can reciprocate with like teaching them something.
Yeah.
So I just had the idea to basically put together like a series of steps, a step-by-step process to teach, you know, novice musicians essentially how to record and, you know, produce their own music. And it's as simple as that. It's like, if somebody finds value in that, then, you know, they could they could, you know, pay me for the course and then learn something. And then that would, you know, it helps to give me, you know, a little bit of income. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the why behind it. And, you know, doing something that I love, you know, I love to teach, I love to help, you know, new musicians. And then it's also just really fun, you know, producing music, like, you know, just working in Ableton and, you know, working with the different plugins and arranging songs, writing songs, recording songs, putting all the parts together. Yeah. It's just, you know, like your analogy of like, you know, a video game that you can play for the rest of your life. It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And yeah, every time I talk to you, I come away with four or five things that are amazing.
That's good. Bits of information. You're one of the few.
Well, it's true. So,
that's good.
Yeah.
Man.
The course is great. I keep it up, you know, by my side when I'm mixing now. So it's freaking
that's cool.
Awesome.
Good.
But yeah, good. You did a great job with it. So
thanks, man.
Yeah. Culmination of, you know, shit ton of knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still growing, still expanding.
Yeah.
So, all right, brother.
Yeah. It was nice.
It's good.
Yeah.
It was good chat.
I didn't know a lot of that stuff. So.
Yeah. Did you find out some new info?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I did too. I wanted to ask you actually before we close out. So tell me the story behind your Gibson acoustic that you've got.
Oh yeah. So,
it's a J45.
So I have guitar players on both sides of my family.
Yeah.
My grandfather, it was his guitar, but it was his father's before him.
Wow. So what is it dated?
It's a 53. I'm 90% sure it's a 53. Yeah. And it's boomy. There's a little like cracking in the bracing a little bit, but other than that, it's like, or it's not even cracking. It's like a separation kind of
the glue.
Yeah. It's literally
like on
just,
the top bracing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, the tuner, original tuners.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah,
I want to see that.
Super boomy. Yeah, it's
awesome.
You should
bring that to the next
pod. It'd be badass.
Yeah.
We will record another guitar with it.
Yeah.
And it just sounds different. Like,
I'm sure.
It's just boomy. And
just
like,
the age of the wood alone, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was my grandfather's guitar. And
how's the action on it?
I'm too scared to even, I'm like scared to do anything with it, like restringing wise.
Really?
Yeah. The tuners are like about to go probably. Like,
yeah.
They're not great.
Yeah.
But the action's great. Like, it probably hasn't been restrung in a couple years, you know, but it's, the action's amazing. The frets are, you know.
Has it ever been refretted?
No.
Still,
the frets are non-existent.
So worn down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're not bending anything on it.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. So my grandfather, he loved like the Beatles and stuff. He just played like chords and stuff.
Sure.
That was his guitar.
That's
and
fantastic.
That's freaking awesome.
Well, I definitely want to see that thing.
Yeah, it's badass, dude.
That's cool.
I just love Gibsons in general.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just
they're great guitars.
The marketing worked on me as a young kid, but something about a Les Paul. I love like the 335s.
Yep.
This guitar is freaking awesome.
Yeah, the Heritage is nice, man. That's currently my fave. I love it. It just plays so great. Sounds great. Looks great. They did a really nice job.
What are some of the guitars you were playing in like the 80s?
Oh, that is a cool question. Wow. Okay. So the first really nice guitar that I had was an Ibanez. Was one of the lawsuit guitars. You familiar with those?
Yeah, yeah. I've heard about them.
So it was one of the lawsuit guitars because you know, I was kind of like getting to the point where I was like ready to move on to better quality guitar than my Univox, right?
Yeah.
So we went with my guitar teacher to this music store close to my house, and they had these Ibanezes there and also the Les Pauls. And I think of like the Les Paul standard at that time was, I want to say like $800, which was a ton of money for my dad. Right. Yeah. And they had the Ibanez was, I think it was like $300, something like
those
that.
Those were known as like great guitars, right?
It was a
like,
great guitar. Yeah. It was a great guitar. And, yeah, so I played them both, but my guitar teacher really played them both. Right. And he was like, man, get this one, save $500.
Yeah.
So, and that was, you know, obviously a concern for my dad. So, yeah, so I had that and I played that for a long time all through Berkeley. And then, I bought like a Telecaster, still had the Ibanez. And then I actually traded in the Telecaster for a Steinberger. Do you know what they
headless?
Are?
Headless? Was it headless at that time? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, they
You're
were
ahead
like,
of the...
it was a carbon fiber, you know, guitar, you know, no.
And this is still the 80s?
Yeah.
Wow. This is,
yeah. Yeah. Ned Steinberger came out with that in probably, 83, 84, something like that, around that time period. Yeah. I actually went to their factory to see where they were made in Newburgh, New York. It was like inside of this house, a little small, like boutique factory.
Yeah.
And that guitar was a great guitar. And it had EMG pickups.
Mm.
They were active. And the neck was kind of like a C-shaped, almost like late 50s Les Paul neck, super comfortable and warm, like that carbon fiber, whatever like polymer they used to make that guitar was great. And I really like playing it. I played it for, I don't know, probably 4 years or so. And then I ended up selling it for some money and Carvin like knockoff of a Mesa Boogie. And then I just, you know, and I had like a Strat with a Kaler, you know, tremolo, because like every guitar player in the 80s
so
had
you, so
that.
You did hop on the when you first said Ibanez earlier, I thought you were gonna say like an Ibanez Jim
no,
or
the
something.
Gems, they didn't
like,
even come out with them until the 80s. That was that was like Steve Vai's thing, wasn't it? Like
the handle.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of cool. So,
so you did go to the Floyd at some point.
And I still have that guitar, actually. Okay. I gave it to my daughter. She's got it. She doesn't play, but I think she just likes
It's a cool guitar.
Yeah. So, and then from there, and then I played that Strat for, a long, long, long time. And then I got, finally went back into the Les Pauls. And that's pretty much what I've been playing for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So
the shorter scale on Les Pauls too, that I know I said, was talking about like, you know, the visuals earlier, but that little bit of a shorter scale, I have smaller hands too. Like, I don't know. It just felt,
Is it a shorter scale than the Strat?
Yeah. It's 24, 0.75 inch shorter. So the Strat's 25.5. I think a Les Paul's 24.75.
Now is that scale, does that translate to like Gibson's acoustics, like the Hummingbird too? Do you know, or
that's a good question. Yeah. I feel like the J45 feels more compact, at least to me.
Right.
But that's a good question.
Yeah. I'll have to look that up.
I know Strats and Tellys, because you can interchange those necks on those. So those are about 25.5.
But
I think Les Paul, I think SGs might also be Strat scale length. I could be wrong, but
okay.
Yeah, Les Pauls have a slightly shorter scale length.
That's wild. I never put that together. Yeah, that's why it always feels a little different, like when I'm going, like if I'm just playing my Les Paul, like I was just tracking some stuff the other day, so I wanted to get some like a bunch of guitars on there, so I was just you know recording some Les Paul playing the part, and then I'd put the Strat on to play just to get some different tonalities on there. But it always felt like, you know, kind of awkward, like first jumping on the Strat. So I don't play the Strat that much.
So when you're like recording, because I had noticed this a lot, like I'll have like a hum with a Strat that I don't necessarily need to address when I'm mixing with a Les Paul, you know, stuff like that. When you're mixing, do you like, you know, like add a noise gate for a single coil guitar? Or, you know, a lot of the stuff I do is like higher distortion.
Sure.
Like, so that's more
so
of an issue.
So you got that in the background.
Yeah. But just, you know, EQ wise, even because like the sound wave from a single coil pickup, it's different.
Yeah.
Right. Than the humbucker in general. Yeah. So,
I mean, for the Strat that I have, they're the noiseless pickups. So I don't get that 60 cycle hum. Although I do have a hum from, I don't know, from the electrical in the studio. It'll go through my amp. So if I take my hand off the guitar, you'll hear it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come through in the recordings. And if it does, yeah, I would just use a gate just to.
And do you like EQ them differently at all? Do you notice?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I've been trying recently to really just focus on getting a good tone out of the amp and using mic placement. So I don't really have to EQ maybe beyond just, you know, trimming off some of the high end and then some of the low end and then just leaving it pretty much flat and then just doing that. And same thing with the acoustic too. Just trying, it's just kind of this, what I'm trying to get better at.
So
just getting a good tone, just going into the box. And instead of having to compensate for not getting a good tone.
Yeah.
You know, using EQ, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
like mic placement wise, what are some like hard and fast rules to live by? Like more in the middle equals this, more towards the edge equals this.
Well, I would just say there are no rules. So just do what sounds good to you. So you're obviously going to get a fuller sound if you place your mic like right in the middle and right in front of the cone, right in the middle of the cone of the speaker, than you will when you're moving it, you know, off to the side, or even if you move the mic off axis, you know, depending on you know how you place in your mics. So I would just say you just strap on a set of headphones and you got your guitar, just play some chords and move that mic around till it sounds pleasing to you. And if you're using two mics, I would say try placing them at two different points on the speaker to see how that sounds. So when you're recording, you know, you're going to get a little bit of a different tonality out of each, and or just change up different microphones.
Yeah.
Like, you know, don't use two SM57s, use you know, maybe like a ribbon mic and, you know,
isn't that like that. Traditional go-to combo, like a ribbon mic and an SM57.
Yeah. And there's a reason for that. It just sounds so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. For
yeah,
sure.
That's the, yeah. I think they started actually making, they have like these things that fit specifically, an SM57 yeah. and a,
they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ribbon mic.
But if you've got a couple like these, you know, these mic stands here, you can just position it right. The main thing is like to get like their capsules aligned so that there's no phase issues, you know, so that the sound waves are hitting both capsules at the same time and you avoid having any phase issues.
And so when you say align the capsules, like they're
so
literally in a line.
Yeah.
Next
so you
to
would
them.
Probably have, you know, something like this, or like with, if you're using a ribbon mic, you'd have like the ribbon mic here, and then you'd have the SM57 like right on top of it, and the capsules for, you know, like the diaphragm within the microphones would be lined up with each other like that.
I see.
So the sine waves come out.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I've noticed like, certain spots of my, like, you know, I'll listen to it back and it just did not sound like it did in the room. And, I've heard
so
kind of conflicting stuff about like, it's more bassy if you put it like, in the middle or something, or it's more bassy if it's in the middle and you lose kind of the bass as you go towards the edge.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, once again, like when you're miking up your stuff, are you listening through headphones or you're just listening in the room without headphones?
That's a good question.
Because you definitely want to listen to it with headphones because that really, because you're close miking it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to hear, you know, what your DAW is going to hear, basically what your DAW is going to record by having the headphones on.
Yeah.
You know, the signal's going into your interface, the headphones are coming out of your interface. You're going to hear exactly what is going to be recorded. Whereas if you're just listening to how it sounds in the room.
Yeah.
Right.
Sounds awesome, but then,
yeah. So you really have to use your headphones.
So just mess around with it.
That's it, man.
You know,
yeah.
Just stick to one spot.
And then what I would do too is like, if you're not confident in like just how it sounds in your headphones prior to recording, just record, make a note of what the mic placement was and then try different things, record and then listen to the playback. And then just do that continually until you get the sound that you want.
Yeah.
So, and then you can always add stuff on afterwards. Like we talked about, you know, like plugins and so forth last week. So.
Yep.
It's just a constant exploration.
Yeah. I finally got the pedal.
You did?
The Marshall pedal, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, sorry, that's... We'll skip to something else.
All right.
That's not we didn't talk about that on the pod, so they're not going to know what the hell I'm talking about. But yeah, it's pretty cool. I can finally get delays on my amp.
Good.
But, yeah.
All right. All right, man.
Yeah.
All good.
I think I'm all good.
You good, Tippins?
All good.
All right. So we'll catch you. We'll catch you in a couple of weeks. And you can find this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you.
Peace.
Peace.